All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fuck publicans, what the fuckocrats, what the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Thank you for joining me. I hope you had a pleasant fourth. I hope you have all your digits. I hope you didn't wreck your car or black out or make any family members cry or burn your hands and face. I hope everything worked out for most of you and you reflected and were thoughtful, or you were just aggravated and excited. Whatever it was, welcome. I hope you had a pleasant 4th of July. I find that, let me deal with some sadness. There's some sadness a couple of days ago since I last talked to you. I got confirmation that one of my ferals, one of my my old outdoor buddies, the one of the one-sided relationships I have with wild animals, with wild cats who I feed, is dead. And I've talked about this guy for a long time. This is a Death Black Cat, R.I.P. DBC. He was an amazing cat, he was an amazing cat in a lot of ways, but the primary one being he was completely wild and he couldn't hear shit, could not hear anything. It was a miracle that he lived. He was an actual spirit animal. I thought he had a mystical quality. I was always amazed to see him when he'd show up, and he'd go away for weeks at a time and go eat somewhere else, and he didn't eat for a few days. I just had a bad feeling, you know. But I always have a bad feeling about that stuff. And then my neighbor Adam confirmed that that his daughter, his little girl Isabel, had found the cat under a tree over there next door, down on the hill, dead. And he didn't look sick, and I don't know. I don't want to get too grisly about it, but somehow or another, I've been blessed with not having to find the animals in my life dead. You know, Boomer disappeared. Butchie died when I was away. Scaredy Cat 1 was dead out in the street and then disappeared. Deaf Black Cat is now dead in a grave down on the hill next to another feline in a small, in Adam's small feline burial site. The truth of the matter is that cat's been around for at least 7 years that I can remember, and I did the best I could and gave him a good life. He lived under the house. It was a miracle that he lived for so long, but he was sort of a symbol of strength for me, Deaf Black Cat. And now he's gone. I remember I took him to the vet once. I had to trap him and take him to the vet because half his face was bleeding and swollen and full of pus. I thought he lost an eye, and I thought this cat cannot afford to lose any more of his senses. And it wasn't. It was an abscess, and I got him back. But the vet said, I've never seen a wilder cat. He was a tough little fuck, and he managed to dodge death for many years, and now he's gone. So rest in peace, Deaf Black Cat. I'm sorry to see you go. Today on the show, I got a short talk with my old writing and acting comrade, Dave Anthony, about his book that apparently he didn't really want to sell. I don't know. he wrote a book based, drawn from his Dollop podcast, he and his co-host Gareth Reynolds. It's called The United States of Absurdity, Untold Stories from American History. You can get that wherever you get books, but apparently Dave didn't think to give me a call. Maybe this platform was not enough for Dave. I'll talk to him about it, but he's here for a minute. And then after that, I talked to Jeff Baena, the filmmaker. Maybe you're familiar with some of his movies. I guess the biggest one that got a bit of attention a little while ago was Joshy, which I enjoyed. He's got a new movie out with my co-star in GLOW, Allison Brie, and her husband, Dave Franco, and Aubrey Plaza, and Kate Micucci, and John C. Reilly, and Molly Shannon. And there's a lot of people in it. Nick Offerman's in it for a second. Paul Reiser does a great job in it. Fred Armisen's in there for a second. A lot of people in the movie, and it's an odd, dirty little period piece based in medieval times at a nunnery. But Jeff Baena is a very engaged, intense, smart dude. and it was good talking to him. So this year, I went over to the regular party I go to at Dan and Jen's house. Dan from Gimme Gimme Records and his wife, Jen, a acupuncturist. Is that what you call him? Is it? Yeah, I think that's the proper term. It's nice, nice gathering people. But, you know, there's a lot of good conversations around, a lot of good food, a lot of roasted pork. My statins are working overtime today because I did make the exception. I did. You know, it's weird when you eat shit like that after a certain age. And I don't know if it's trackable or you just start to wonder, which burger did you in? Which burger just filled that tube going into your pump? Which one was it? Which was the last straw? Which piece of pork? Which rib? Which burger? Which egg? You know, which one was it? And was it worth it? If you could have avoided that one burger that finally spackled your pipe, you know, would you have done it? But, you know, I've been good, and the pork was good, and the desserts were good. Pie, a lot of pie fucking happened. I think I annoyed Dan's wife, Jen, because, like, she makes this huge, she slow cooks his pork all day, so, of course, I'm just going to be lingering around the kitchen helping out until the pork comes out. And then, again, I go back, and I'm lingering, just hanging around, waiting for the pies to come out, offering some help. Can I put that pie on the table and watch you slice it and take the first piece? Is there ice cream? Is there any shame in that? Why have decorum? I don't want to be cut out of the pork or the pie. But I went home and I felt like, you know, maybe I should try to behave like a fucking adult. But I've never been cool or an adult or anything else. I'm either sort of withdrawn or kind of aggravated or just running around like a fucking child. That's a pretty good range, though. Spent some time talking to a guy I kind of know, Joe Wong. A lot of soundtrack people. He does movie and TV soundtracks. But Joe Wong has a podcast that he only talks to drummers. He's a drummer. It's called The Trap Set. So if that interests you, musicians and drum aficionados, go check out Joe's podcast. He kind of he claims he based it on this, but it's drummer specific. All right. So Dave Anthony is a friend. We should be spending more time together. He lives close by. We should be hanging out. But for whatever reason, we don't. And when I told him, I said, I can't, you know, I saw his book in Chicago at a bookstore. And I was like, why the fuck wouldn't he come over and try to talk about his book and maybe get people to buy it? I don't know, but I'll get to it with him. So this is me and Dave Anthony having a tense reunion, a friendly tense reunion, which is every time we get together. Wait, where do you record your podcast? What is it?
Dollop.
The Dollop.
You're supposed to know the name.
Dude,
how long have we known each other?
Okay, I know the dollop. Of course I do. I just had a brain fart for a minute, but I thought you were going to say that I was supposed to have done research particular conversation.
Let me give
the backstory.
Go ahead.
So I don't see you for a long time for whatever reason. You know,
we're both busy and we're both isolating.
So it's nothing personal. Well, we've worked together a lot. We like each other. We have a good time when we hang out for a little while. And I'm in fucking Chicago doing a shoot, and one of the locations is a bookstore, and I'm looking at their table of new books, and I'm like, the fucking Dollop book? Does Dave not want to sell the book? I mean, like, I'm down the street. I have people who I like on my show to maybe help sell the thing they made, but I guess he doesn't want to sell the book at all.
So you have a podcast that you do stuff on?
Yeah. I'm sorry. Did I need to shoot your reminder that we're still on the air over here?
I remember I had a list of people.
What was on that list?
And then you were on the list.
In parentheses?
Did you never get a book?
No, I didn't get anything.
This all seems very weird.
Yeah,
because I think what happened was is I had a list of people, and then I know what I did. I got to you, and I've seen all the shit you get.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, I have to hand deliver this to him, because if I send it to him in an envelope, it's going to fucking sit there on the ground.
Oh, that's what you thought?
Yeah.
But I didn't get a text from you or anything.
That's a complicated and involved process to reach out to another human being.
Really? To say, I got a book coming out. Yeah, I want to send you one. Maybe I could come on and talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah, so right there, there's a lot of levels to that.
Well, let's talk about those
levels. First of all, I'm leaving my house.
Well, what about the level of sort of like, I'm not going to give him that. No, I'm not going to let him have any. What about that level? Fuck Marin. I'm not going to put myself in that position where I got to kiss up to that guy.
There's a lot of, I think there's a lot of jealousy with my book, because I don't think your book has the same sort of
jealousy
pictures.
Oh, pop-ups.
We have a lot of drawings in here. So you didn't buy it in Chicago. You just looked at it, and then you were a little bit angry.
That was weird. My anger was so stupid because I'm like, well, fuck him. If he doesn't want to let me help him out, I'm not going to buy his book. Convoluted.
I was just like, I remember thinking I have to actually hand deliver this to Mark, but then I never.
I know, and it
just sits there, and I get it.
And then you sit at home and go like, I don't know, why isn't this book selling?
Yeah, it's not selling. Why isn't what's going on?
And then everything it works out exactly as you expected, Dave.
Yeah.
Then it's like,
I told you we shouldn't have done the book. I told you.
I told you we shouldn't have tried to sell it. I told. So convoluted plans on both sides.
Have you ever heard the podcast? That's the thing. Have you listened to it?
I watched you do it live once.
Oh, that's right.
And the thing, I like it, but like I wouldn't take that personally. Like, ask me a more broader question. Do you listen to any podcast?
Yeah.
Try that one.
Do you listen to any podcast?
I don't, Dave. I don't know why. I don't listen to one podcast. You know
Not
why?
One.
Here's how I take in audio material. I'll put on my Sonos occasionally.
Yeah.
For the last 3 months, I'm so engaged in the news in print that I don't even listen to NPR news. And most of the time I listen to records or I listen to music in my car. I primarily listen to music, and that's it. That's the story.
Even when you're traveling, you listen to music?
I do. A lot of times when I'm traveling, I don't listen to anything. I'm so inundated with music on an intentional basis. Sometimes when I travel, like on a plane, I'll watch some movies, or I'll just sit there and listen to the plane engines in a mild panic.
That's first of all, that's not good for you.
I know.
You should always have some sort of noise happening that can distract you from your own thoughts.
And sometimes if I'm interviewing a musical guest, I'll be busy listening to their entire catalog for no reason.
But yeah, you gotta pretend like you're doing research.
Well, I'd like to get a handle on something. I'd like to know where it went bad and why I don't know the most recent 20 records.
Well, you never know the recent 20. I mean, after a certain point. Because after a certain point, you go, I get what you do.
Right.
And then you're done.
And then they think they're doing something miraculous and amazing, and sometimes they are.
Sometimes they do put out good stuff when they're older, but just no one's listening.
So the podcast is you take bizarro American.
It's not even bizarro. It's just sort of. You know, I guess the best way to describe it is like History of the United States by Howard Zinn.
Yeah.
I sort of took that
People's history.
So I try to look at history from the people who were being persecuted or, you know.
Oh, really? But sometimes you do smaller stories too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, like, we do small. There's smaller stories for sure. I think the book is mostly full of.
These were all stories that were featured on the podcast?
Yeah, except for one that we threw in there. But,
so you got sports stories?
Yeah, we got a lot of sports stories.
Medical breakthroughs?
Well, there's a lot of medical.
What's the lobotomy stuff? One? Freeman's lobotomy.
That was a guy who basically started a lobotomy craze because they had a lot of people in hospitals that it was just packed full of people they didn't know what to do with.
And is that when Frances Farmer got hers?
No, I think she came later, but at the tail end.
Like the new great psychological breakthrough.
Totally.
This will work.
And this guy went around like, I mean, he was like a rock star and going
with his little ice pick and
yeah, and do a bunch at once and
really?
People be lined up and then so they'd
just,
be like,
just stick that ice pick up into a frontal lobe and
just knock that person into dumbness.
Just blender it.
Yeah. And then like, well, you're fixed. And then the doctors be like, this is great. Now he sits in a chair and smiles.
Perfect. Thank you for doing that.
Yeah.
I wish you would have left the ability to use a fork in there. That would have been helpful to everybody.
Yeah, so he went around doing that, and I think at one point he had a gold-plated pick and a
really?
Hammer, and like, yeah, he was like Henry Ford setting up a factory.
No,
like,
no,
he was just
the guy.
Rolling them through, and he's doing a bunch. And
so, what was the commentary angle on that? I mean, like, why that story?
Well, for us, there's a big emphasis on how. What medicine started out as and what it became. And the fact is that it was a crazy, barbaric thing that he did. But at the end of the day, it helped lead us to chemical fixes for these.
Well, they were able to, like, well, he got the area right. The lobe seems that to be
exactly
where how things do we, are happening.
Yes.
Now, how do we leave their personality intact?
How do we not do it with a hammer? Yeah. So all that stuff.
And what's the death of George Washington?
Well, they bled George Washington to death.
Oh,
that's how George Washington died. They believed in bloodletting then, and three different doctors came in to treat him in one night, and they all bled him, and at the end they had taken half of his blood, and that's how he died.
Really?
Yeah.
And what was he sick with something though?
He got in like a really bad cold, maybe possibly pneumonia. He was just out. Hilariously,
was he in his seventies though? Was he old?
He was in his seventies, but he went out on his farm for whatever reason in a storm, and he got soaked, and he was in his dinner clothing, and he refused to be late to dinner, so he just sat there in his cold, wet clothing, eating with his wife. And then after that, he went upstairs to change. So he got really sick because of that.
So maybe at that point, the president was didn't have his full capacity,
or slightly stubborn to the point of death.
and what was your angle on that? What was the commentary? Like even the father of our country was a dummy.
No, that was another medical one of just you don't hear about that, but they bled our president to death, our first president, because they thought they were doing the right thing when they were clearly.
What's the Kentucky meat shower?
That's just crazy.
No, I just really, a lady, I wouldn't have known that from the title.
A lady was just out in her yard.
Yeah.
Doing a little laundry, and a bunch of meat fell out of the sky, and then everyone was trying to figure out where it came from.
What about what's the Tim Doc Anderson story?
Oh, that's a guy that's still alive. He is a boxer, was a boxer in Florida, and he was part of this manager who kept wanting to take falls.
Yeah.
And he was trying to build up another boxer, so he told him to take a fall, and at some point the guy wouldn't, so he drugged him, and whatever he drugged him with, it lasted for years.
Oh, my God.
And he confronted the manager. And like
this guy,
because he didn't know what was wrong with him. After a while, he confronted the manager, and the manager's like, "I'm going to kill your sister," or whatever. And then he ended up shooting the manager, killing the manager. So now he's in jail,
right?
But it's one of those he didn't know he was going to die. You poisoned me, like,
oh my God,
yeah. So he got life in jail, but so I kind of think a bit much.
You and Gareth Reynolds, who does the primary research?
I do. Gareth is the funny part of the thing.
He brings it's important that you have one of those guys.
I'm the straight man. Yeah, you funny, know that.
No, you can be funny. I've seen you be really funny. But I understand you need a different type of funny.
Well, I mean, it's not like on your show, I would sort of carry
the... You were psychotic.
Yeah. So I would carry the scenes with my hilarity.
All right. Well,
yeah, and now it's sort of the opposite on the podcast.
I think what really happened was we both added to a certain dynamic that created the humor.
Yeah, there was a relationship that was sort of accentuated our issues, and then from those I got to come in and steal scenes.
I knew that was a wind up. You know, like I know that it was going to start out pretty good. Like right when I heard you started, I'm like, is going to end the way it always does?
Yeah, it doesn't. I mean, don't give me room. Why don't you give me room?
But what is the process of, like, you do two of these a week on the podcast?
Yeah, so I do a lot of research. It's a lot of work, and I write them up, and then he's never heard of the subject, so I just sit down and read it.
And the only context is you just think it's weird, or you think it's an interesting story.
Or it has something in it that relates to today.
Like,
there's a lot of stuff I do that I try to parallel, you know, whatever's happening.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because like I initially thought that, because I don't listen to it regularly, that it sort of has a tabloid element, but it doesn't really. Some of it is.
It's more of a social commentary element than a tabloid element.
Right. Like, look at how fucking weird people are.
Yeah. And look how fucked up things were. And shit's not that different.
It's still fucked up.
Turned up. Yeah. It's not that great. I don't know if you've noticed what's going on. It's not really that great.
People are telling me.
Yeah.
You should. You know what drives me nuts? Is there are people out there in the world who are just going about their lives and are just sort of like, yeah, I don't know really what's going on.
I was at the gym today, and the lady next to me was watching Extra, and I was like, how do you do that now?
I know, I feel that too, but like there's also a part of me that's sort of like, well, I have to remember to do that occasionally.
Yeah, check out and just kind of...
Well, I don't know if it's checking out. It's like by being checked in, ultimately, unless you're actually, taking action, Yeah. All you're doing is just heating your shit up.
Yep.
And just going like, we're fucked.
Yeah, we're screwed. Yeah. And then you just sit around and that's what you're doing.
That's what you're living in.
Yeah.
So unless you're like taking it in and going like, well, I'm going to send some money or write some emails or go out into the streets. All you're doing is like, oh, it's not getting any better. You don't... Why aren't you watching Extra? Well, what's the point?
Why?
It's over. It's over.
Yeah, why would you want to watch that? No one cares.
Well, I would never watch that anyways, but I do try to have conversations with people and stay on top of things. It's very hard for me, knowing I have a platform, to not just become one of those kind of strident, existentially panicked, aggravated people that's just sitting reeling off the news and reacting to it, because... There is humanity still going on. So like, I'll choose to, to pick stories that sort of like, well, this is where the human spirit kind of won. Yeah. Or, kind of related to that. Like, because the just ramming up against this fucking doofus is, it's just feeding it.
Oh, it just feeds it.
Yeah, it's like, he likes any kind of attention.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what it is.
Any sort of swirling madness, he's like, this is great.
So what else is going on? How's the kid?
The kid's good. The kid's a little baseball freak.
Right. Oh, yeah. We talked a little bit about that. I just feel like you on the field, you're coaching too.
Coaching, getting into arguments and possible fights with other coaches. I may have told a guy to fuck off on the Little League baseball field after he screamed. I can tell you this. The one
you're not
going to
deny or confirm it? Or
I'm not going to deny it. That's what happened. I went over to them to... Hey, can you talk to your team about misbehaving? They're being kind of bullies.
What were they doing?
They were badgering our kids, yelling at them, you pitch slow, just that kind of kind of stuff you don't want to happen with little kids.
Yeah.
And I went over to say, hey, could you talk to your kids to make them stop? And he got in my face and screamed at me, and I thought we were going to get in a fist fight.
Oh, so you knew exactly where it was coming from. Like, not only were they not going to stop, but he was probably encouraging.
I immediately realized, oh, this is actually coming from the top.
It's a top-down thing.
And so he was screaming at me, so I did what I always do, which is I looked at him and I said, fuck you. And then he got more mad because I swore around children.
Oh, really?
And then he said, what did you just say to me? And I said, go fuck yourself.
Oh, good.
And then he didn't know what to do because he thought I wasn't going to... He thought I'd be like, oh, I'm sorry, but I didn't. I doubled down.
Yeah.
And then he got very angry and he wouldn't shake my hand at the end of the game and all that stuff. And then I went home and I looked him up.
Yeah.
And he used to be Jeb Bush's press secretary.
Oh, see, it all comes around. Everything is political. There's no...
Yeah, it really is. And he used to also, when he was in college, he was the college mascot, Bobby the Bear.
Ooh.
Yeah.
So he's got a lot on his plate.
He's got a lot
of baggage.
And I know if I see him around town, I can go, Bobby the Bear, and he'll lose his mind.
That's your ace in the hole. You're ready to... All right, so this book, The United States of Absurdity, Untold Stories from American History, Dave Anthony and Gareth Reynolds. And this is with a foreword by Patton Oswalt. I might as well mention that because that was your big idea, wasn't it?
What, to have Patton Oswalt?
Oh, yeah.
To do that foreword?
That was going to sell it, right?
Yeah, I think.
Did it? Do you know? If books are hard.
The publishing company's happy.
You get these quarterly sort of invoices that just show you how much money you didn't make. It's just like in parentheses against your advance, much in debt you are still.
I just assume I'm going to get some that says almost.
Yeah.
And
you'll get them for years unless a miracle happens.
But this one, they ordered a second printing because they didn't think it was going to sell that well, and then it did.
Oh, good.
So it's who knows what, I don't know what the numbers are.
And the podcast is popular?
Yeah, the podcast is doing well. We're not.
Is it still limited to Australia or is it spreading?
No, we're actually more popular in America than Australia now.
Wow.
Yeah, we came around and
good.
Yeah, it's exciting.
Well, it's good to see you.
Nice to see you. We should see each other more than once a year.
We live down the street.
We do live super
close. I don't know what it is or who you hang out with, but I know you long enough and I've heard you talk about enough people to where, like, I'm one of the better ones that gets, I understand
you. Yeah.
We actually
together. You understanding me might be the issue.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. You'd rather just sort of like, hey, can you just let me be a dick? Can you just, that's sort of what I do publicly and with most other people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you still work out at my gym?
I belong there. I'm still able to.
I never see in there. That's
I know. She goes to the yoga classes sometimes.
Yeah.
And I tend to work out with a little this woman who trains me down the street over here.
Okay.
But I do want to go up there.
Yeah. Well, it's
what
not
do you
far.
Do there?
I just mostly ride the bikes. Maybe a little bit.
I tend to like run outside.
Run on the circle thing up above the
No, like I tend to run out here. Like
outside
your
house.
Out in the world.
How is that?
It's great.
It seems terrifying to me.
Well, it's quiet up here. Like I can go up in the hill. There's no cars.
But there's enough room to run around up here.
There's like hills. Like now I'll run up the street and run down. And then I'll walk up this big steep hill and run a little bit and come back around. And like running on the machine, like it's just sort of like.
Now running on a machine is tedious.
But if I could get into the habit, so the other stuff, like the working out business, I do with her. But I should go up and do some classes, like some yoga, man. I'm in yoga for a while.
I'm thinking about jumping into a Pilates thing.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's hard with the machines.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I might. That's,
it's subtle. Like, you don't realize it until the day after when like, you can't stand up and you shit your pants.
And
like
you're crying.
Yeah. I got to go easy on this. Lost control of my digestive system. I think I pushed it too
hard.
That's
the kind of workout I want is when I stand up and just evacuate my bowels.
Preferable to get to the bathroom first, or you don't want to go back to that class. You don't want to be the guy who shit his pants.
Well, if I stand up and shit my pants, I go, oh, it's working. I'm getting in shape.
To the shocked look of housewives. Who let that guy in? All right, buddy. Well, maybe I'll see you up at the gym.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Yep. There you go. So go get his book. It's fun. There's pictures and, you know, it's a nice, maybe, you know, I'll take this into the bathroom book. You know what I'm saying? So Jeff Baena is a guy I met, you know, where did I meet him first? Oh, yeah. We were set up on sort of a coffee date by the agency. And we had a great talk, and then I had him on, and I went to a screening of his movie. It was very funny. While the little hours was still in post-production, when they were still tweaking it, you know, Jeff let me come watch it where they were doing the editing in a screening room. So it was a screening, and you never know what a screening is going to be, how many people are going to be there, who's going to be there. And I remember I showed up and I was waiting for Jeff, and then, you know, another guy walks in and it's Father John Misty. So it was just me and Father John Misty at a screening with Jeff. And it wasn't awkward, just a, you know, very small and kind of a interesting crowd. Me, Father John Misty, and the director. But the movie is funny. It's raw. It's good. It's a unique thing, that's for sure. And it's based on a very old piece of literature, which I found compelling. And I talked to Jeff about it. But this is me and Jeff Baena. The movie is The Little Hours. It's playing in New York and LA. It's going to be expanding throughout the country this month. So this is me talking to him, to Jeff, the director and writer of the thing. It was very funny to me that, like, I'm going to see the screening of this new movie. Alison Brie's in it, who, you know, I just worked with, and John C. Reilly, and Aubrey Plaza's in it, who is your girlfriend.
Yep.
Molly Shannon. Kate McCucci. But like, I didn't know what to expect. I know that you told me it was based on the Decameron, which is a big book, and this is one story in that book. Mm-hmm. I read the Decameron, I think, when I was in a satire class in college, right? Who wrote the Decameron?
Giovanni Boccaccio.
So you invite me to this screening, and I didn't know who was going to be there, and it turns out it's just me and Father John Misty sitting there. What's his real name again?
Josh Tillman,
who I've met. And it's just me and Tillman.
Well, you did it, the WTF with him, right?
I did, yeah. And it was just an odd thing. Like, it was just, to me, it was very odd. It's just like going to be me and Father John Misty watching a movie with you.
Perfect audience.
Yeah. Are you guys real tight?
We're friends. I wouldn't say we're super tight. He's better friends with Aubrey.
Oh, okay.
She's known him for years. She did a music video with him.
Yeah. But the movie is it's kind of raw. It takes place in what's the date?
1347
it's not a convent.
It
is a convent.
It is a convent.
And the premise is that, you know, like some of the stuff that I didn't know about that time was that some women were sentenced to convents in a way. Right.
Well, most women. I mean, the way it kind of worked was a convent was a school. So especially if you were noble, you'd go to a convent and then at some point you come out. You know,
right.
Graduate.
Right.
Either get married or you just lead your life. But there's a bunch of sort of considerations that I guess we don't have now about people, the way people were treated.
Yeah.
And so if you were the youngest kid, generally a man or a woman, you'd be a priest or nun.
Right.
If you were not married, you become a nun. If you were divorced, you became a nun. If your husband died, you became a nun. And then generally, if your father wanted to have favor with the church, the more daughters or sons he had in the church would be better. So it just, there's all these different versions of how you end up becoming a nun.
That's the Middle Ages.
Middle Ages. Then a little bit later, I think in around 1410 or 1420, women started almost doing it as a feminist movement where they would like choose to become nuns.
Yeah. And it was very funny because Alison Brie's character is there because her father wants to have, a relationship with the church, right?
Yeah.
And the father could not be any more Jewish than Paul Reiser, even in the scenes, which I thought was funny.
Yeah.
And when I talked to you afterwards about this, because it's really about sex in this convent, mostly, right?
Yeah.
Would you say?
Yeah.
And that's directly from Decameron?
The sex aspect?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what I told you afterwards was it felt somewhat like Alex Cox's movies, or specifically Walker, for some reason, because there was something about
the anachronism.
Yeah. And also that there seemed to be not as much of an intentional infusion of modern sensibility into the dynamics between people, but it was definitely there, that you felt like the setting was what it was, the premise and the story was what it was, but there was the activity and visceral type of engagement between these characters seemed sort of modern and raw.
Well, I just think that's timeless. I think that's humans.
I guess that's probably true, and yeah. I guess we don't usually think about that time.
That was pretty much my intention, was to sort of bridge that gap, so that when you're watching that time period, you don't have this sort of hazy sort of buffer between you and that time where you're not connecting with these people, but they're just people.
Yeah.
That, you know, obviously they don't have technology and they're, you know, nuns, but they're just people. They have the same desires and the same hopes and dreams.
And they're filthy, just like they've always been people.
Animals.
And filthy animals with struggle and conflict. And how did this work out? Because, I mean, you don't spend a lot of money on movies. So how do you get to shoot in Italy at this beautiful place?
It worked out really well. So just sort of like going back in history, I guess, and I sort of preface all of this. I went to NYU. I got a degree in filmmaking. I also got a minor in medieval and Renaissance studies, which wasn't on purpose. I took a bunch of random ass classes. Like, I took a class on Harmony of the Spheres, Arabian Nights, Jewish mysticism. Mm-hmm. And one of the classes I took was called Sexual Transgression in the Middle Ages and Renaissance.
Yeah.
And we studied the Decameron and the Heptameron and the penitentials and just sort of the whole history.
Yeah.
And what it did was it opened my eyes to this time period. You always think of nuns and priests and all these people as sort of just being these like religious robots that are just going through their day and almost so unrelatable. And the penitentials are sort of the punishments the church levies against people, you know, for different transgressions. And there are so many of them. And it was so specific and rich that you just realize people are just doing fucked up shit all the time. And, one of my teacher explained to me is nuns weren't obviously wanting to be there. They were just kind of stuck there by circumstance. And sometimes like the Mother Superior isn't the most religious or the most rule oriented. They sometimes were just the oldest people that were surviving, and they were like party girls. And so it was almost like they were having these like crazy orgies all the time. And it was, you know, hoping no one would look. And there was a crazy bureaucracy to the church, obviously. And the higher up you are in the church, you kind of want to look better. So you everything that's below, you kind of like, you know, pushing under the rug.
Right.
And so there wasn't a lot of accountability. There was just like this shit show happening. And so
obviously in the more demonic and evil way, it had been happening with the pedophiles for centuries.
Yeah. Yeah. You just brush everything under the rug and you just hope it goes away because people are fallible. And so I always wanted to make this movie. And then Joe Swanberg, who I know you've worked with.
Yeah.
He was crashing at my place and I was telling him this idea, and we were actually watching Dog TV, and he was like, this is amazing. You got to make this movie. And so I called my producer, and she did my first two movies, and she's like,
what were the first two?
Life After Beth and Joshi.
Yeah.
And she's like, you're not gonna believe this, but one of the investors who's invested in our last two movies, she's this Italian lady who's in Tuscany, and she's been asking for like 4 years for them to shoot in these medieval villages. And you're literally asking to shoot in a medieval village in Tuscany. And within like a month or two, we were in Tuscany scouting. This woman, Marilena Marcucci, her family was like loaded from, I guess they're in the plasma business from the 20s or something, like in pharmaceuticals.
Business?
Plasma, like fake blood.
Yeah.
And so she, and then she brought MTV to, or she did some version of MTV for Italy. Her family's just loaded, and her brother's a senator who runs the film commission. We were so crazily hooked up that, I mean, we didn't have to spend as much money as we normally would, because we had access to, we had this one guy, Alessandro Bertolucci, who was sort of our liaison. He was kind of our line producer, and he knew all the mayors of these little towns that had all these, you know, relics. And
any relation to Bertolucci?
No relation at all.
Yeah.
It's just a common name.
Yeah.
I figured.
Yeah.
But it's not.
Yeah.
And so it kind of just snowballed really fast from this conversation I was having with Joe to, we were actually in Italy on the ground scouting locations. And then a couple months later, we were shooting it.
And now how heavily scripted was it?
Not that heavily. It was maybe like a 25 or 28 page outline.
A lot of improvising.
Dialogue was improvised. The story was not improvised, but a lot of the dialogue, I mean, and the dialogue, the specific dialogue. So the scenes were written out, what each person was going to say and what was happening in that scene. But After doing Joshi, I sort of changed my process, and I start off as a writer. It's like a hardcore writer where you almost don't change a word at all. There's like no improvisation. And you
like the control of that. At that time?
No, it's just how you were taught to do stuff.
Right.
I actually don't. I don't mind. I like freedom, and I like things kind of like bleeding and sort of getting blurry.
Yeah.
And I also like how honest and authentic it sounds when people are saying their own lines instead of forcing someone to say something that doesn't sound real.
Well, there's something more present about it, certainly.
Well, they're looking in each other's eyes and connecting, not knowing what the next person's going to say. So they're really present.
Listen. Yeah, you have to.
And that's for acting. That's the most important thing. It's not just waiting for the person to finish their line. Like you see like really bad movies, you know, like Ed Wood stuff. And you almost see like the person like kind of mouthing the other person's lines, waiting for their line. Like that's
some people
me.
Have that weird habit. I know people that do that while you're talking in real time.
Really?
It's very odd. Yeah, my friend Sam does it. Like if I'm just talking to you now,
like finishing your words, or
not really finishing, but like just like a half a beat after saying what I'm saying.
He's like processing it. He's got like,
I think so.
A delay.
I think he's listening, and as he listens, he mouths it.
Maybe he has like some coping mechanism because he's got some ADD or something. He's like trying to figure out how to like.
I've just noticed it as being a weird habit. You know, I think some of it's finishing sentences, but some of it is just, you know, kind of like the way that people listen.
It's interesting.
It is interesting.
Yeah. So I just found that creates a more real dynamic.
Right. And now how much did you shoot?
Like how many days?
Well, I mean, how much footage did you end? The weird thing about digital and after working with Joe, I think the real challenge is that you sort of have an embarrassment of riches usually.
Usually, if you have a lot of time. We were under the gun. So, you know, we shot the whole thing in 20 days. Pretty much with the exception of just stuff that takes place in the convent, if you see a location, like for instance, a church or a field, every single thing that takes place in that field was that day.
Yeah.
So sometimes we're stacking like 8 or 10 scenes a day.
Yeah.
So sort of jamming through it. So we didn't have a lot of coverage. So, you know, generally it's the first 3 takes is sort of a master.
Yeah.
Or, you know, something kind of wider.
Yeah.
And then after that, we just punch in and we're pretty much replicating what we did.
So now tell me exactly what you were like. I mean, I remember after we watched it that, you know, talking about it as a comedy or as, you know, necessarily trying to put it into a genre, that it was not something I didn't feel like you wanted to do that.
I just don't want to do that ever. I mean, I think what happens, especially with the way media is sort of like disseminated today, everything is marketing.
Yeah.
And so everything is labeling, everything is sort of compartmentalizing.
Right.
And so your experience is almost pre-digested before you experience it.
Yeah.
And the only reason I'm doing this is to kind of do new stuff.
So it creates expectations.
Creates expectations, and it creates disappointments.
Sure.
Because if you're like, oh, I'm going to see a comedy.
It's the same thing, really, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it leads to it's one leading to cause and effect. But I think, especially with comedies, that word comedy is so vague. And, you know, there's obviously like, you know, levels to it. There's dark comedy, there's broad comedy, all that kind of stuff. But I don't think of it as like, I'm going to write a comedy or I'm going to write a dark comedy. I'm trying to make my own thing. And then what ends up happening is people try to sort of figure out a way to describe it.
Yeah.
And then that is not really the best, you know.
Well, but you knew going in, like, that's what the interesting thing about that is, however you want to describe it, you know, you've got, you know, the actors I just mentioned. And then in bit parts, you have, you know, Fred Armisen, you have Offerman. These are, you know, comedic actors. Really?
They're comedic actors, but for me, a comedic actor is someone that can do comedy. That isn't always doing comedy.
No, I know, but they're known for that.
They're known for that.
Right now.
Yeah.
But like, I'm curious to know, like, cause like, it was hard to sit there with you in, you know, looking at a rough cut, well, which wasn't really a rough cut other than, I guess, the credits, but so yeah. It was pretty tight.
Yeah.
And then to have to talk about it, there's a sort of, you have to be, I didn't really know you. So it wasn't that I was diplomatic, but I was certainly trying to figure out how to talk to you about it. Mm-hmm. Now that you showed it for large audiences, you know, what was the feedback? Was there something more specific that you found resonating with people? Did people say more than like, that was interesting or fun or, you know?
I mean, the good thing, when you do it at Sundance, that's the your real first time anyone's seen it. So no one's bringing in any expectations other than, like you said, the cast. And
they're hoping that something is different and weird and new, and they're surprised.
Completely. And to some extent, I'm not at a place now where I'm a recognizable brand.
Right.
But when people have seen a couple of my movies, they know what you're getting into. It's not going to be a straight up comedy.
Sure.
And I think one of the things that was really great is I was hearing a lot of people saying like, this isn't anything like I've seen before. You know, there's a couple of sort of, I think, stale comparisons. You know, people, I think, automatically go to like Monty Python or Mel Brooks because, you know, those guys were doing period piece comedies.
Right.
And so that is something that people can glom onto. But
right.
In terms of, I think, like in terms of the craft or anything like that, I don't think anyone is that kind of knows their way around stuff will identify that as sort of like a marker. I think it's more just sort of an easy way to digest it.
Now let's go back a little bit. I know we talked a little, but I retain some things, but you grew up in Florida.
In Miami.
Right in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm.
And what I can't imagine, Miami's a chaotic place.
Yeah. Especially when I was growing up.
Yeah, why? Because what was that, the 80s?
Yeah, it was the 80s. I mean, I grew up pretty much at the height of the cocaine boom. So yeah. I got to see a lot of that stuff.
Like just people being gunned down in the streets and insanity and coke money everywhere?
Yeah.
What do you remember about it?
I mean, I remember my neighbor across the street was murdered. I remember a lot of my friends in school, their parents were busted for either being smugglers or I went to private school for 1 year in eighth grade.
Yeah.
And then there was a bunch of actual drug deal. Like I got to go from public school where everyone's like, you know, the closest you got was like maybe their dad was a smuggler.
Yeah.
You know, like riding the boats at night. And then when I went to the private school, it's like their dads were the kingpins.
Right.
Just for that 1 year.
Yeah.
But, yeah. I mean, everywhere you look, there was coke and it was... Yeah, it was pretty gross. And it was Miami Vice. Like that's
right. That was the time.
Yeah.
And what did your dad do again?
He's an attorney.
Right. Yeah. And he stayed above it somehow.
Sort of. I mean, I don't like I might be speaking out of turn, but all my family's from New York. Like
yeah.
And the only reason we were in Miami is because my dad got a job down at a law firm and right after he graduated. And the guy whose firm that he got a job at was this guy named John Helliwell.
Yeah.
And this sounds like conspiracy theory shit, but the OSS is the precursor to the CIA.
Right.
So the OSS was started by John Helliwell and Wild Bill Donovan, I think his name is, and a couple of other guys. And so they were, you know, doing sort of, you know, crazy stuff in Italy and Germany, like with partisans to try to take down the fascists. And then that ended up becoming the CIA. And so this guy ran the CIA for a little bit. He was a lawyer. And then after he left the CIA, he started this law firm, Helliwell, Melrose, and DeWolf, where my dad got a job. And effectively what they were doing was opening banks in the Bahamas, in the Caribbean, for the CIA and drug dealers. So they would take their drug dealer money and then use that for CIA operations.
Uh-huh.
And then I guess towards the end of it...
The Contra thing, right? We talked about it.
Yeah,
it's like,
definitely the Contra thing.
Yeah.
And I think like a couple of the lawyers in that firm were busted for various...
So they were running covert operations at the behest of the intelligence agencies outside of the parameters of government.
In fact, the FBI came after John Helliwell because they saw what he was doing. And, you know, the CIA and the FBI are not best friends. And they were coming after him. And I guess the CIA kind of prodded them and like, just leave him alone. Like, he's an older guy. He's about to pass away. This is like, cool. Just let it go. But yeah, my dad, that's how he started off doing law.
Is he still around?
Yeah, he's still around. Like I know he deposed Somoza.
Oh
and
my God.
He helped extradite Vesco, and he was involved in a lot of weird Latin American stuff.
When you were a kid?
When I was a kid, yeah.
So you didn't quite grasp it, and you still don't, because you can't, or they'd have to kill you.
Exactly.
Keep my kid out of it.
Yeah.
Stay in the dark. And what did your mom do just during
teach her? Well, she when I was a kid growing up, she was just a mom.
Yeah.
And then she went back to teaching.
How many brothers and sisters?
One brother, little brother. Two
little brother?
Younger.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Is he out here?
No, he's a detective. He's a sergeant in the police in Florida.
In Miami?
In Coral Gables, in Miami.
That must be exciting.
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, he gets high-speed chases every once in a while. And I mean, I don't know if he's actually pulled his gun. I mean, Coral Gables is like Beverly Hills in Miami.
Sure, sure, yeah.
So it's a lot of, you know, robbery.
Are you guys close?
Yeah, we're close.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. And I mean, so we're super different, but yeah.
And you, like your grandparents were New Yorkers and that kind of thing, where you always tapped into New York, so you're always going up there?
Yeah.
Because how do you, you know, in order to be a kid that had your interest, something had to spark you.
Like, in terms of like film stuff?
Well, just like, you know, being a 14-year-old who finds Eno, I find that's a specific thing. That like, you know, because I'm the same way, and I don't know whether it was, my mother was an artist, and you know, and I always felt that that was important. Mm-hmm. Like there's something that hits you when you're younger where you're like, you know, art is where it's at. Whatever the fuck it is.
Yeah.
You know, being outside of whatever this norm is to find truth and to find yourself. Is something you don't have much control over. Either it happens to you or it doesn't. And usually there's somebody that just delivers the message to you somehow.
Yeah, I think I got lucky. I had a bunch of those things kind of happen to me.
So, yeah, like what?
I remember when I was like 11, we had Way Cable in my bedroom.
Yeah.
So I was always watching TV, but I was watching movies all the time.
Right.
And one time A Clockwork Orange was on TV.
Right.
And I caught it in the middle of it. And my dad walked in and he's like, oh, you're watching that fucking weird movie. I'm like, what is this? And he goes, I think that's A Clockwork Orange. And I'm like, this is crazy. And so the next day we went to the video store and I'm like, Dad, like, what's another crazy movie? I want another crazy movie. And he's like, I don't know. 8 and a half is supposed to be crazy. I don't know. Really? And so we rented 8 and a half and I watched it. And
different
like
kind of crazy.
That's what, I mean, he just, for him, it was like just weird movies. Right. Like it's just this one genre.
Right, right. Sure.
And yeah, so, that's what made me want to do film.
So you rented 8 and a half.
I rented 8 and a half. It blew me away. I mean, I was like probably too little to fully grasp it, but I knew something. It was sort of like, you know, stuff where you're listening to it and it's pushing you in an uncomfortable space, and you can either like shy away from it and turn it off, or kind of give into it and sort of see what happens and just trust that this artist knows what they're doing. And that's what I did. And
because you were a kid and they're grown ups, why would you question the artistic integrity of either of those things? At like, what, how old were you?
11.
Yeah. You're like, this Fellini guy's a hack.
I definitely didn't have that sort of critical ability.
Well, that's interesting because both of those movies visually are so, you know, unique and fucking, you know, they really punch you in the head.
Yeah.
Like 8 and a half, even if you don't know what's going on, you're going to be like, what the fuck?
Yeah, you can just be absorbed by the style of it.
Yeah, you can't. You don't even have to listen to it.
But the themes are obviously where it's at.
Yeah.
And I think also my mom, right around that time too, she was a really big fan of The Metamorphosis by Kafka. And she's like, you should read this. And I read it and that blew me away. I was too young doing this stuff. Like I was watching Radar movies when I was like 6 or something.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I definitely was, you know.
So you read Metamorphosis. I mean, I remember reading that and I still couldn't grasp it completely.
Yeah, I mean, remember reading it and thinking it was actually funnier than it was supposed to be. I thought it was supposed to be kind of sad and messed up, and then I was like, this is actually kind of, there's,
yeah, the guy's a bug.
There. The guy's a bug, but sort of just the matter of fact dryness of it, I was really drawn to.
So that was the Trinity. Kubrick, Fellini, and Kafka.
Yeah.
That blew your mind initially.
Yeah, for sure.
And you're like, there's something else out there.
I remember Time Bandits was a really big thing for me when I was a kid. I don't know if you know that Terry Gilliam movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the end of it really like, kind of messed me up in a good way.
Yeah.
Where, you know, his parents, they have the it's like a toaster, and the demon's head is inside of it.
Right.
And he's like, don't touch the head. And they touch it, like just defying him, and then they explode. And I remember how dark that was. I'm like, you can get away with that kind of stuff. Like, you can have the parents just die at the end like that. And yeah, that definitely stayed with me.
You sure you can get away with it? I mean, is it going to be a popular movie? I don't know.
Yeah.
But so then what do you do to begin your artistic journey? Do you pick, you know, music or drawing or what?
Where all of it. I mean, I was drawing all the time. I was painting. I took painting
you
classes.
Did?
Yeah.
So you were like, I'm going to find it. Something. What's going to stick?
Yeah, it wasn't even like I'm intentionally trying to be. Right. I didn't even think I wanted to be an artist. I knew when I was 11 or 12, I can't remember when, I was like, I just want to be a director.
Yeah.
But before that, it was always just, you know, I don't have a good singing voice, but I like playing music. Like, I'm not good at any individual instrument, but I'm like decent at all of them. Like, I can like play drums or guitar or whatever. And I was always writing. It just sort of seemed like film was the thing that kind of brought all these things together that I had like a sensitivity to.
Right. And when you went to high school, what were the kids you were gravitating towards? I mean, we went to high school. When did you graduate high school?
95.
Right. So I graduated in 81. It's a whole different fucking world. So by 95, you definitely had enough like-minded people around, I would think.
Yeah. And my school was a super outlier too, because I don't want to get in trouble, but the principal at the time, there were rumors that he was a coke dealer.
Yeah.
And he actually helped me skip school a couple of times. Like, it was a completely corrupt, it was almost like the way, it was completely a Bill Clinton style school where It was definitely corrupt and sketchy, but it was ultimately like utilitarian and for the greater good.
Right.
And so it was really like, it could almost be like a TV show the way it went down. Like the jocks and the drama kids and the nerdy kids and like the artsy kids, everyone was cool with each other. It wasn't like bullying. And
right.
So it was like a really kind of, and it was, I went to school with like 5,000 people. Like it was a massive public high school.
Yeah, I had a big one too, like 3,400. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there was definitely like, you know, gangs and fights and stuff, but there was an overall vibe of like, we're kind of in this together, which it didn't exist for any of the other classes. It was just my year. I think we somehow figured something out that was kind of cool. And the teachers were pretty cool. There's just one guy, Mr. Hood, who he actually passed away like 10 years ago, but he started a cinematography class. So we would actually make movies in class and watch movies. I would go see, I remember I saw Kozlowski's Red with him, and you know, he was always making me dubs of, you know, the Todd Haynes Superstar, and he gave me Blow Up on VHS, and he just gave me some really cool movies. He was a big Fellini fan, and so, and he was also a really big Bowie fan. We like tripped out on like Low, and he was awesome.
Did you ever like watch any of those other ones? What, Red Desert?
Yeah.
Oof.
Passenger.
Yeah. They're hard movies.
They're great.
I just remember like just wanting it to make sense.
Uh-huh.
Like I had this expectation, which it seems like you were able to sort of jump over fairly young just by virtue of what you were taking in, where if I didn't get it or it didn't make sense to me, that I was missing something, that I couldn't just take it in.
You can just have like a holistic experience.
No.
Yeah.
Could you?
Yeah, because I think I'm able to zone out sometimes,
yeah,
and I don't get kind of caught. I'll watch movies multiple times. I'll watch a lot of, you know, movies more than one time and just kind of like let it wash over me sometimes and just pick up the pieces. I one thing I learned about the way you should see art isn't you don't go to a gallery and see every single painting and just stare at it and give it an assigned amount of time.
Yeah.
You just sort of drift to what draws your attention and then focus on that. And
right.
You're not doing a chore when you're watching art. You're experiencing something, and whatever resonates with you, you should kind of go with that.
And also, like sometimes I have found that things that I that may have caught my eye or resonated with me when I was younger, or even if I didn't quite get it or like the artist, whatever medium it was, that as I get older and I go back to things, I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
Now it. Yeah. I mean, I just.
That happened with Roxy Music. I love Roxy Music, especially the early stuff.
Yeah.
Speaking about Eno. But the later stuff, I think I had like a reaction to kind of reject it because they rejected Eno and I kind of was defensive for
him. Yeah. And also there was a lot of sort of suave suits and kind
it's
of
a little cheesy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's beautiful. Love it.
That's great.
It's so good. So yeah, I don't know if it was like.
There's a problem with Brian Ferry, you know, in terms of like taking him in as an entertainer and as an artist. Like there's something about his stature that's sort of like, eh.
He's almost like trying too hard to be charismatic.
Something.
It's like Bowie, it's just effortless. And with Brian Ferry, it's like, he's like, check me out.
Yeah. Right. It was.
Smooth.
Yeah. I had the same reaction to him.
Yeah.
Like with Leonard Cohen, like I'm just now, like it's now connecting with me.
Oh, he's connected with me from the beginning. He's like one of my all time people.
What was it? It's so sparse to
it's
me.
So
I mean, I love to say like McCabe and Mrs. Miller is really one of my favorite movies.
So good.
Ever. Like, I love those songs, but like, you know, to take on the whole Leonard Cohen catalog.
Yeah.
At the time I watched McCabe and Mrs. Miller, I couldn't grasp it.
I love melancholy stuff.
Yeah, me too. But I still couldn't, like, there was something about a lot of it that I didn't quite get until not too long ago. That movie, like the more I watch that, it just blows me away every fucking time.
Oh, it's so good. I mean, that's to some extent what I was trying to do with Little Hours, which is, you know, find a historical period and kind of just tell it in a really contingent way instead of having it hit all those like points that you're expecting it to hit. Kind of just, it's fallible people and just sort of watch it play out. I mean, that's obviously Altman, who's a master doing his thing.
Yeah.
But that movie is super inspirational.
It's like it's an insane movie to sort of like, I feel like I need to watch it again.
Yeah. It's I could watch that movie and Altman movies I could watch, you know, California Split.
Yeah.
That's probably my all time favorite movie. I could watch that movie every week.
Really?
Yeah. His movies for me are just the easiest things to watch. They're just like the language he's speaking. It's just, I digest it instantly and I just love it. Like I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if he picks the right period, like in McCabe and Mrs. Miller, that juncture of commerce and the wilderness and the, you know, the death of the Old West, it was so fucking dense. Like it, but yet, you know, you can watch it casually. But, you know, if you just want to investigate you know, that guy who's building that church.
Yeah.
And really, you could write a paper on that.
And it's also like McCabe is that a general Western would have McCabe as the gunslinger. And we don't know his exploits. We don't know how talented he is until the end of the movie.
In a minute, a second.
Yeah, but up until then, you're sort of just watching this guy kind of hiding out.
And also, but he's also like not only a flawed character, but bordering on a comic character.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I had a discussion with somebody about the choice of the derby.
That he's wearing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that's a comedic hat on some level.
Right.
And that he was
it's
sort
like
of
a fancy hat.
It's a fancy hat, but it's also a chaplain hat. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you start thinking about his bumbling around and his inability to connect with this woman, you know, and his mumbling to himself, that there is an almost slapstick nature to him.
And it's so tragic as well. Like his inability to connect with Julie Christie completely, you know, the fact that they're simpatico, but there's a limit to how far they're willing to go, and the sort of unsavory choices they've made in their lives have sort of, I guess, metastasized into who they are that doesn't allow them to connect.
So the first time you really learned about film in terms of technical things was in high school with the cinematography class?
Yeah, I mean, I was always messing around with video cameras and Super 8 cameras.
Do you have those stuff still?
Yeah.
Do you have your movies?
Yeah, I still have some.
Yeah, did you digitize them?
Not yet.
No?
No, I actually like how they're falling apart. It's kind of amazing. Yeah.
What would you shoot?
Like what kind of short films? Like,
was it stop action stuff?
Like no, it was always dramatic, comedic, you know, like stuff with people. Not a stop motion animation. Just, you know, like little. I remember when I was a kid, I was watching Nickelodeon.
Yeah.
And this is like a stupid story, but there was a show and I can't remember the name of it. Like so this is not really like a great reference, but there was a show where it's like a bunch of people in leotards would get on top of each other and make shapes. Like they would turn into like elephants or whatever,
right,
just by working together as a team.
Yeah.
And so they would always ask for suggestions, which would basically be like, hey, send us a thing and we'll, you know, be a tank or something. And then they could do it. I sent them this like 4-page, and this is when I was like 5 or 6 years old. I had my dad help me, but like a courtroom drama.
Yeah.
And they're just like, we can't, you know, this is not going to happen. So I was always trying to do something a little bit more dramatic, I think, than probably like I was capable of doing.
Yeah. A courtroom drama.
Yeah. And they're like, this is not exactly for us. And they sent me like a Black Beauty VHS tape as like a consolation prize. But yeah, we don't act. We just sort of make shapes with our bodies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you picture them in your courtroom drama doing what?
Oh yeah,
they
no, I was so into it. I was, you know, because like I think, you know, my dad's a lawyer, so I was looking up to him, and I probably wanted to be a lawyer at some point. And then I was like, this is a great story I'm going to tell, and they just were not having it.
So what was the first piece of cinema that you put together that you thought had, you know, was solid?
That I directed myself.
Yeah.
Was it before
NYU?
Yeah, I mean, I did a short film to get into NYU.
Yeah.
It was with my teacher, Mr. Hood, who I referenced before, about a kid who realizes his parents are cannibals.
Uh-huh.
And that was pretty fun.
Yeah.
It was like the most, I guess, professionally done thing. I did a contest for Twinkies. They asked us to do like they asked people to do like a short piece for like something that had to do with Twinkies.
Yeah.
And I did some random ass, like I mixed together a bunch of short film tropes, you know, like Fellini and Bergman and Truffaut.
Yeah.
When I was in high school, and we got second place, I think.
Second.
So we got a lot of Twinkies from that.
What won first?
I don't know. It wasn't like, there was no internet back then. So it wasn't like you really were able to like do that. I feel like to do that kind of research, you'd have to go real deep.
Yeah. Before the internet.
Yeah.
Do you know a guy that can get me the tape of the winner?
Yeah.
Right. So when you went to NYU, when you moved to New York, you know, was that the big, what were you setting out to do?
I wanted to be a filmmaker, and I wanted to not go to a campus school. I wanted to sort of be in the world. Growing up in Miami is great.
Yeah.
You know, the beaches are amazing. All my friends are great. But I just couldn't wait to get out of there. Like it was to me like a, not a cesspool, but it was definitely like something that was limiting.
Yeah. And yeah.
There was no cultural element. Like I think now that you have, Art Basel and Wynwood is kind of becoming a thing, and you know, the design district, there is an element now of, but back then it was, you know, everything was Romero Brito. I don't know if you know that artist, but he's like a bad version of Keith Haring that's really colorful.
Right. There's a lot of money, but not a lot of taste.
Not a lot of taste. It's like LA minus the mountains and minus the entertainment and culture. So
right.
You just get all the negative stuff. You literally get people driving around in Lamborghinis and Ferraris, you know,
yeah,
mesh shirts. And
yeah.
So like I was looking to get out of that and go to a place. I mean, New York for me always was a place I wanted to live. My parents are from there. You know, every piece of film that I really liked.
Family there?
Yeah, I still have family there.
Yeah. And did you then, where you're like, was there anyone when you went to college? Did you have
I mean, all my cousins and my aunts and uncles live there. I mean, pretty much everyone in my family was in New York except my grandparents and my parents. Everyone else was up there.
So, all right. So you go to NYU and what do you learn?
I mean, more than anything, it's just how to be on a set. You know, they don't teach you how to get a job. They don't teach you, you know, how to write stuff. They just teach you the formats.
How it breaks down
and how to do it. Not specifically what to do.
Yeah.
And so for me, that was really invaluable. I didn't want people telling me how to make stuff. I mean, what to make.
Yeah.
You know, I always had an idea of what I wanted to go for, but how to load a camera, how to light something, you know, how to record sound. All that stuff is really, I have a good memory, so I'll remember all that stuff. Like, I ended up shooting everyone's movies in school.
Yeah.
So
how to format a script.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, what program to use.
Yeah.
All that stuff was like super important, but I never was, you know, I never thought of it as, a lot of people I know that went to school there kind of like talked down on it.
Yeah.
As if it was like, I don't understand why. I thought it was great. Like, to be able to live in New York City at that age,
yeah,
to be anonymous, you know, kind of blend in, but also be able to, I mean, that was in the 90s and there was a lot of really cool creative stuff happening, and especially with independent film. And
who were your classmates? Who were your teachers? Anyone we know?
I had a teacher for Italian cinema called Antonio Monda.
Yeah.
He ended up doing the commentary on 8.5, the Criterion version. I had a couple of kids that I went to school with that kind of became stuff, like Jonathan Liebsman. He directed Clash of the Titans, or one of the Clash of the Titans.
Oh, yeah? Were you shooting stuff?
I was shooting stuff for sure.
Who were you using as actors? Any New York people that, you know, you used
actually
again?
Rob Delaney. Do you know him?
Sure.
So we went to school together. I know him since I was 18. So he was in a lot of my stuff. Like, he was my guy.
Robin, so you knew him through the whole crack up?
I knew him. Well, he actually, you're talking about when he got into his accent stuff.
Yeah.
He was leaving my house. Well, so we were hanging out that night, and we had a friend, Uzai, who he grew up with, and they were kind of hanging out at my place. It was like 2 a.m. I mean, I was too young. I was like 22, I think, at the time.
Yeah.
So I didn't see all the warning signs of what was going on. But he left my house and went to a friend's house who was having a party at 2 a.m. And he was one of those guys like that would bring over a 6-pack for himself.
Right.
But, you know, when you're that young, everyone's just kind of partying and doing stupid shit.
You knew they're like, wow, that dude can drink a lot, but you didn't connect it to like, he's a problem.
Yeah. The weekend before, it got a little dark because I was doing this documentary on, you know, World's Strongest Man competition.
Yeah.
I found this pocket of guys up in Sacramento that were trying to do the same thing, that were trying to go pro. And he came up with me and helped me like kind of work on this documentary, and he was drinking a lot. And then it got a little bit dark, and then we came back, and then he left to go to this party basically at 2 a.m. I'm like, what are you doing? And I guess he started drinking and blacked out, and then just took off at 5 a.m.
Drove it into the water building or something.
He took a bunch of meters out. And
yeah. No, I mean, I've talked to him, you know, and he's sober a long time, but, you know, we went into depth about that event.
Yeah, no, that was, I mean, I've never seen something as transformative for a person as that. I mean, there is a chapter shift. Like, things changed
after
that. Of
course, yeah, he got sober.
On all fronts, like he had a lot of stuff going for him. Like he started getting casting callbacks and things were happening.
When you were like 22.
When he was 22. And then, you know, after that, you know, his knees and his elbows were busted and he couldn't go out. And, you know, it's like when you first get into AA, you become like a true disciple. You know,
right.
It's like there's no Catholic, like a new Catholic, whatever.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it became his whole life.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I think slowly he sort of got a little bit more balance and stuff.
Right.
But I mean, he's one of my favorite people in the world.
And you used him in college and movies?
Yeah. He's in my first movie for a second, in Life After Beth.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I always want to work with him, and I love him.
Yeah. He's doing well.
Yeah. He's doing great.
So you did one big film in college, or short films? Or
I did a bunch of short films. Yeah. And my thesis film didn't happen. My teacher didn't turn in my insurance form, and they just disappeared like 2 days before we were supposed to start shooting.
Your teacher disappeared?
Yeah. This total jackass. Like he was supposed to... Pretty much, they give you an allotment for film, like, you know, equipment and stuff. You got the insurance for that. But you end up getting other film equipment, like you rent out from rental houses, and you need the insurance form in order, because you're a student, like no one's going to cover your shit.
Yeah.
And he never turned it in, and then like went AWOL. And so NYU felt bad, and they're like, hey, why don't you just come back for another year and we'll guarantee you, you know, an allotment. But like they wanted me to spend $40,000 to go back to do senior year of again. And it was just...
Why would you do that?
Yeah, exactly. It's like... I don't know.
Yeah. So you left film school and came right out here?
Came around here. I started working for Robert Zemeckis.
What movie was he doing then?
What Lies Beneath and Castaway. I got really lucky because a friend of mine that had moved out here showed me what his resume was, which was like ridiculous. It said where he was born and stuff. And I didn't know what you're supposed to do on a resume.
Who does?
So I put down that I was born in Miami. And it turns out the guy who runs Jack Rapke, who runs Zemeckis' company, he was from Miami and went to NYU and thought I was like his second coming. So he hired me. And so I got to work on what allows me to think Castaway like a PA, and it was really fun.
You were on Castaway as a PA?
Yeah. Holy not shit. not in Fiji or Bora Bora.
Right.
It was just the LA stuff.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And so you're right in it.
Yeah, I was right huge. In it. Yeah, and like I grew up, I was a big time Zemeckis fan. Like I love Back to the Future and Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Yeah.
I really loved Used Cars for some reason. I don't know why.
Used Cars with Kurt Russell?
Kurt Russell, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So good.
Did Zemeckis take a liking to you?
Yeah, he was really sweet. Like whenever I would go, I mean, I was pretty much just doing gopher runs kind of stuff. But he would always let me kind of come and sit and watch them work. I remember one time he's like, "Hey, do me a favor, go get Steven at the gate and bring him to me." I'm like, "Great." And there's a guy named Steve Starkey who's his producer.
Yeah.
Who I'm just assuming I'm going to go get. This is like literally day one of my job. And I see this like turquoise Explorer pull up and it's Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
So I have to take Steven Spielberg to him. And like, that was like mind blowing. I remember Steven Spielberg was giving me like a pep talk and, you know, like, "Oh, really? Bob's a great guy and you're in great hands," and all this stuff. And it was just so surreal.
And so, but they knew you were lit up and intelligent, right?
Yeah, but that's not the best combo for like an office worker. Like,
or a PA. Sometimes it can work against you.
Like I'm sitting there like looking at all the film stuff and they're like, "Well, can you go get the dry cleaning and like make sure I have enough oranges and, you know, make sure I have my petty cash." Like that's like your job is.
Right.
But like I'm like, "Okay, cool. But I just want to sort of stay here for like a little bit longer." So.
Yeah. And how long did you work for Zemeckis?
Like almost a year. And then I started working with David Russell.
So you're 21?
22.
Where are you living?
In Los Feliz. I've lived in Los Feliz the whole time I've been in LA.
Well, that's a pretty good move.
Yeah.
And you're like connecting with people of your age and like you got a crew out here.
Yeah.
And like everybody was doing their PA work or getting their little breaks here and there.
Yeah.
Like who were your crew?
A lot of NYU kids. I hung out with a lot of actors, honestly. Like,
yeah.
I don't know why. I'm friends with tons of actors. And yeah, it's like fun watching them sort of like kind of find their way or not find their way and like become pastry chefs and stuff and just sort of like find their own thing. But
yeah,
but it was definitely fun.
So you go right from Zemeckis to David O. Russell. How'd you get the job with David O. Russell?
I applied to a job list ad for a director who was looking for an assistant editor, mm-hmm. and I know how to edit. So I applied and then I met him and we had like he interviewed me and I was actually putting Flirting with Disaster on Laserdisc, which is like super dating it, but I was putting the Laserdisc on as he called to say, "Will you come in and meet with me?" I had no idea who it was. And so he was working on some online documentary that ended up nothing ever came out of it. But I would just start editing stuff for him.
So by the time when you started working for him, he had made Spanking the Monkey. He had made Flirting with Disaster.
And he had just finished Three Kings.
Flirting with Disaster is a great movie.
It's amazing. It's perfect.
Yeah.
That's some of the funniest shit ever.
Yeah, I don't know that people talk about it enough. And there's some great acting in it, too.
I mean, I think that's my favorite movie of his.
That's with Ben Stiller?
Ben Stiller, Tia Leone, Richard
Josh
Jenkins.
Josh Brolin's in it.
Brolin, Alan Alda, Lily Tomlin.
Yeah. It's like an ensemble comedy.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was like it's almost a genre movie in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
It's like a road trip, finding yourself movie.
Right.
And he's finding out who his parents are.
Right.
He's adopted.
Yeah. Right. I got to watch that again.
Oh, it's so great.
Because, like, you know, Spanking the Monkey I've watched a few times. Flirting with Disaster a couple of times. I like. And Three Kings I watch whenever possible. I should probably own it. Because there's something so... that movie to me is sort of a masterpiece somehow.
Definitely. I mean, it's you know, talking about not having a real genre. You know, it's an action movie. It's political. It's funny. It's got pathos. You know, it's shot really well. You know, it's whip smart.
Yeah, it's really amazing movie.
And so I mean, I guess it's timely. I mean, I would say timeless because it's applying to everything.
And you know what I remember about it always, in you know, getting back to Blood and Guts and getting back to satire, which I think Three Kings probably is in a way. Definitely, I would
definitely satire. I mean, the army and oil
is that weird cutaway to the inside of the body.
Yeah, you know, David thought that CSI ripped him off with that. You know, because it shows the sepsis. You know, where the bullet's going in, and you start seeing the effect of. Yeah, he was pretty convinced that CSI ripped that off.
Well, whatever he may have been convinced of or not, that I thought that as a specifically satirical device. That you know, there's something. you know, that goes beyond humanizing by just making that choice to do that, by mm-hmm. taking the time to show a bullet entering inside the body
yeah.
that is so, like, you know, specific, but, you know, the humanity of it is disturbing.
I mean, it's like the I guess the more grounded version of when Austin Powers, when he runs the guy over with the steamroller, and then you yeah. see the wife get the call of the henchman's wife getting a call that he died, and she's like super distraught.
Yeah.
Which is like, you never go that far.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that, like, you know, but it also, it's sort of like, you know, it's just the raw goods.
Yeah.
The animal
goods.
It's
like, this is what's happening.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it gets glossed over. I mean, I remember I had a panic attack one time when I saw Avatar. You know the movie Avatar?
Yeah.
I saw that and I started tripping out on the fact that you're seeing thousands of people die and every one of them has a life. You know,
yeah.
I think it's what's it called, Sonder, when you sort of project yourself into all these different
right,
lives.
Right, yeah.
And then just the sheer, I guess, number of people that are dying and the lives that are... I like literally lost it when I watched that movie. I'm like, this is a fucking nightmare. I hate this.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, when I have those feelings, it is overwhelming, especially if you have... you know, an Eno brain, which is sensitive,
yeah.
that, you know, the amount of anxiety available if you open yourself up to those possibilities is like, you know, can be annihilating,
yeah.
mentally annihilating. Yeah. How'd you pull out?
How did I pull out of Avatar?
Yeah, of the panic attack.
Oh, yeah. I just realized I never had a panic attack before. It was literally my only panic attack. I knew I was having a panic attack, and I know when you're having a panic attack, you're supposed to realize you have a panic attack and breathe, and it will end. You're not having a heart attack, and you're not
right.
going to die.
Yeah.
But it took a while, you know. It was definitely like,
oh my god,
a nightmare.
So what would you learn, you know, with David O. Russell, who is notoriously difficult?
Well, when I came on with him, we were basically tight. We were super tight. I mean,
he took you under his wing.
Took me under his wing, but at the same time treated me as an equal,
uh-huh.
which was insane because I was like 23.
And how old is he?
He's 20 years older than me.
Okay.
So he, you know, he had done 4 movies, I guess, at that point.
Uh-huh.
Or 3 movies. I don't know if it was 3 movies.
And he's a genius.
Super genius. And I mean, so talented. And I like that time when we were writing together, to me, is like one of the highlights of my life, because we were on the same wavelength, and he's so talented. And he just taught me how to sort of have an ear for things.
How did you get to a point where he said, let's write together? You know, you're entering as what, a glorified PA or?
I mean, I was an assistant, uh-huh. assistant editor, uh-huh. assistant editor, assistant. Yeah, what really happened was I don't know if this is like too much, but I had this weird dream this one night that I was driving in a car, and I saw this big white sphere, and it looked like, I knew it was a motorcycle, and I
yeah.
clipped it, and I got like, I made a little like dent on it.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh shit. And as I was driving, I saw a cop behind the thing, and I saw him put his lights on. I'm like, oh shit. And then just as I look at my rearview mirror, I saw this green truck lose control and hit me. And I was like, great. Now the cops are going to be more focused on that accident than the little like thing I did.
Yeah.
So the next couple of days, I was super paranoid about getting in a car accident. Cut to 2 days later, I was at Franklin Western at a stoplight, and I looked at my rearview mirror, and I saw a green truck lose control and hit me from behind. And I got out to like deal with the accident, and there was all this dust in the air, and some of it got in my eye, whatever. So I went to David's house, told him what happened. Everyone was like tripping out about this dream, because I had told my girlfriend at the time about the dream, and then like literally got hit by a green truck. And David was like so fixated on this, what is the white thing that I hit? You know, this white sphere. And then as the day went on, my eye got really messed up, and his wife took me to the eye doctor, and it turns out I had an ulcerated cornea, because I wear contacts, and I guess
yeah.
like a piece of dust got in there and started eating it away, and I would have gone blind. And then we realized like me like knocking off the cap of the white thing was my eye. And it was just this whole crazy thing. So for like 2 weeks, I had this ulcerated cornea. So I'd put these drops in every hour in the hour, and I couldn't really sleep, and I was losing my shit. And I think he felt really bad. So he started telling me about some of these ideas he wanted to work on. Told me about the Huckabee's idea. There was another couple of things that we worked on. And then he started like spitballing ideas at me. And we had like, especially when we were doing the editing stuff, we had like a real easy sort of rapport in terms of creative stuff.
What,
like,
you were editing that online thing he was working on?
Yeah, because like when you're missing a scene, or when you have a scene that leads to another scene, it's not exactly working. You got to find the glue between it.
Yeah.
So I would start pitching ideas, you know, and so he just started kind of spitballing ideas off me. And then we just started writing together. And then... I don't know, I was like 24, 25, and then I was working with him, you know, nonstop. We wrote 4 scripts together.
You wrote Huckabee's?
Huckabee's. We did like a Meet the Fockers version. Like a Meet, is it Meet the Fockers? Meet the Fockers.
Yeah.
And then we did this script that I love, that I think is the best thing we wrote, about this dermatologist who like joins basically the forum, Logan
yeah.
Mark forum.
Yeah.
And then, you know, becomes a mess. And I can't remember the other thing we did.
Never made it to screen?
No, New Line got it, and it's sort of in turnaround. So... But yeah,
it's still in the works.
no, there's no way it's going to happen. They had too much money against it. But we, we just had like a really good way of working. Like we would sit next to each other and just pass the laptop between each other. And it was like we shared a brain. And I just learned so much from him.
Like what?
I mean, the main thing I learned is just sort of how to juggle characters at the same time. You know, how to create distinct characters, put them in a situation. He calls them confabs, like confabulations.
Yeah.
And sort of just like let that scene play out. And so I've always been drawn to like chaos and, you know, large groups. And but I don't like just arbitrary chaos. I like where you kind of are able to track, like you can actually parse through it and say like, oh, this is that tack and this is what this person's doing and this is where their motivation is and how it all kind of collides and that it actually works out in a way that
right.
is chaos, but there is a logic to it.
Right.
And so I think
Huckabee's is all about that in a way.
Yeah, I mean, ensemble comedies of, you know, people coming together and crashing into each other and just all the stuff that happens. So I learned a lot about that from him.
And you saw a movie all the way through. I mean, you guys wrote Huckabee's and, mm-hmm. and then you were on set with it.
For the most part, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a difficult movie. I like that movie a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why necessarily. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I watch it and I like right when the first time I saw it, I'm like, well, this is like absurdism. This is like a Eugene Ionesco play. This is a farce of some kind. And I don't know that I could completely understand it. I don't in my recollection, the thing that triggered my analysis of it was that Marky Mark's a fireman. Mm-hmm. I don't know why, but he just showed up as a fireman. And what was the construction? What was the intent?
I mean, David had a dream about a detective following him around in his everyday life. So he wanted to do something where a person is sort of charting your every move and sort of doing an existential analysis instead of, you know, a legal or, I guess,
right,
anything like that.
A philosophical analysis.
A philosophical analysis, but, you know, a metaphysical philosophical analysis.
Right.
And he kind of pitched that idea to me, and I was always drawn to philosophy. I read a lot of philosophy and studied a little bit, and I've always been interested in that. And I think the timing of it was auspicious in terms of sort of the zeitgeist. You know, a lot of people were coming out of 9/11, and there was this shift, I think, in terms of comedy, especially with sincerity, where after 9/11, it was okay to be sincere again. I think coming out of the 90s, everything was so ironic and so glib and so sort of harsh and acidic. And I think all of a sudden people had a moment to kind of come together. And, you know, the reason why Wahlberg's character is a firefighter is obviously 9/11.
Right.
And so he's the kind of person who up until that point would have just sort of been coasting through life and kind of doing his thing. And then all of a sudden someone that you don't associate with having deeper thoughts and sort of going deep, not that firefighters don't have deep thoughts, but in general, we sort of don't attach that.
Our idea of them changed.
Yeah. Our idea of changed. And then, you know, especially after the way it all kind of played out, then we go to war. And like, why did we go to war? Was it because we want justice? Is it because we're just... it's socioeconomic, petrodollar stuff. Like what are we doing?
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of people have those questions, and I think it kind of, and there was also, I don't want to call it new age because I think cheapens it a little bit, but there is sort of a metaphysical sort of openness that started occurring around that time as well. You know, you saw the how yoga started blowing up and, you know, people were more conscious about their diets and stuff like that. Everyone was just sort of taking stock, I think, after that. And the reverberations, I think we're still feeling them, obviously. But at that time, it sort of felt like that was what we were kind of connecting with. And David and I, well, David specifically was really on a Buddhist path, you know, at that point. I don't think he is anymore. But, you know, we were studying Zen, and we got way into Zen. And sort of these ideas were sort of percolating. And I think we just created this sort of mishmash, like a pastiche of all these different things that we're like culling from.
Right.
And the craziest thing is that was a studio film. Like can you imagine?
Yeah.
Like at one point that was gonna be a Warner Brothers movie.
Yeah.
Like Warner Brothers was supposed to make that movie, and then they just like obviously like were smart, and you know, for them, like that doesn't make any sense. But
who ended up making it?
Searchlight, Fox Searchlight.
And how did you guys feel about it?
I think it's cool. I mean, I haven't seen it since it came out.
Yeah.
You know, like it was definitely, there's what you intend to make and then there's what ends up being made.
Yeah.
And I mean, truthfully, I wasn't on set at the end of it.
You guys had a falling out?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, because I've heard rumors about, you know, what happened on set and, you know, that, you know, he kind of lost his mind and whatever.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I don't know that you can speak to that, but whatever, you guys grew estranged?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't want to get too gossipy, but yeah, we grew estranged.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And still?
Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, it was a lot of stuff happened. A lot of crazy shit went down. So like, it's not, I always respect him and love him for who he is, because he's a true visionary and a rebel. And it's hard to sort of separate someone's art and their soul and their actions.
Yeah.
But you know, he's a true artist and he's a super genius. And when we were writing together, it was one of the highlights of my life. Like, I remember one time we were, he got an award from Amherst, because he went to Amherst, and we got wind of Antonin Scalia was giving a speech to this like pre-law class there. I can't remember the name. I think the guy's name was Arkes. The teacher's name was Arkes. He was like a pre-law or whatever it was. So we snuck in, and it was, you know, horrifying, because he's not my guy.
Yeah.
And Scalia was going off about the Constitution and how, you know, you're not supposed to, obviously his whole take on it is it's not a living, breathing document. It's a set of laws that are very clear, and you know, you think about what the framers were thinking of and just go apply that.
He's an originalist.
Yeah, you don't think of it as something you can interpret, because you can't interpret a law.
Right.
Because then anyone can interpret a law, and it's subjective. So anyway, he was saying, like, back then a felony was, if you committed a felony, it was instant death. And he goes, not like now, so that's pretty effective, huh? And it was like, so like, ugh, like you're just gonna kill someone for a felony. And then I remember he so at some point we were being rushed out, and David goes, threw something at him, like, you know, how dare you with, you know, the Gore election. And then I remember he goes, Scalia goes, have some dignity, like, how dare you interrupt my process. And then I said, well, you interrupted the election. And then, like, who are you guys? And they started screaming at us, and then we ran, and I remember running through the quad, like, just running for our lives away from this thing. It was, like, so much fun.
You and David O. Russell running from Scalia?
Scalia and his, like, cronies. Yeah, uh-huh. It was awesome.
Wow.
So, like, there was a lot of fun stuff that happened with us. And, like, honestly, creatively, I don't think I've ever met anyone that I've identified with as much. And it was, like, a real education.
Yeah.
But,
do you think
you
guys will ever bring it around?
Maybe. I mean, I'm not opposed to it. It's just, you know, people change and people do stuff that's kind of hard to swallow. And,
right.
You know.
Yeah. So when that happened, it sort of, you know, whether the timing was right or not, or whether it was a good thing, how it felt at the time, it kind of, what, that's when you took up on your own.
Yeah, I mean, it was directly related to that. So the pretty much, I think it was like the fourth week of filming is when I kind of pieced out. I started writing my first script on my own that ended up becoming my first movie, Life After Beth. And
you made that?
I made that. I ended up making it 10 years later. I wrote it in like 2003.
What'd you do for 10 years?
I was just writing studio jobs. I was like doing, you know, rewrites and stuff like
really?
That.
Really?
Yeah.
That's what you were able to get from working with David, that you had done some rewrites.
Yeah, I mean, my first thing I wrote became a feature that got produced. So like you get in a exclusive
Did you share
club.
The credit?
Yeah, it was me and him.
And like, what kind of rewrites were you doing? Because rewriters are sort of unsung, sometimes heroes, sometimes guys just making a buck. But it's amazing how many people I know that aren't credited for anything, but did a pass on big scripts.
I did a pass on a bunch of stuff. I can't remember anything that like, it was a lot of stuff. There was a couple of originals that, I mean, I'm dealing with studios, and I mean, I don't know if you, like, you can tell by my last movie, I don't have necessarily the most, like, studio.
But is that just a fee thing where they're like, give this kid 25 grand or 10 grand and let him do a pass and that's that?
No, I was doing, like, originals, too. So, like, you're getting paid a lot of money to...
You're writing original
scripts. Original scripts, yeah. It's not like I'm doing a polish.
So you had a script. You had a script deal.
Yeah, I was always doing scripts for years. And I think, you know, coming off of that experience, I was... In 2003, I wrote Life After Beth to direct... Almost made it with Searchlight. It got really close, and then it kind of fell apart the last second. I think I was discouraged, and I'd never wanted to be a writer. I wanted to be a director.
But when you have a script deal, what does that mean? It's like you got three script.
Oh no,
deal
it's not like it's. I didn't have like an overhead deal. I would just do job to job. They would send me, you know, they'd send me scripts, and then if I like identify with them and I thought I could fix them, or if it was an idea that I thought like would be fun and work on, I would do it. But you know, eventually it kind of like wore out its welcome, and then I just started getting back into trying to direct. But I think that whole experience kind of, that whole time period was like a little bit dark.
Yeah.
And so I try to like.
Because of what went on with David?
Yeah. And just sort of like, that whole time was like kind of a mess.
Slight disillusionment?
Definitely more than slight. Yeah.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
About like what you could and couldn't do in this town?
Yeah. Or like what you can get away with, what people were open to letting happen, and also like what wasn't allowed to happen.
And how can you make what you want to do happen?
Yeah, and then you're just sort of like, okay, I got it. And then obviously as the economy started going south, and if you start tracking, that time period was sort of this like highlight creatively, I think, of the mini major studios. You have all these different guys, you know, like Wes Anderson, David, Alexander Payne, Spike Jonze. They're all kind of blossoming around that time. And then a little bit after that, those companies start shutting down. Like, there's companies that don't exist anymore. Like, Warner's Independent doesn't even exist anymore. There's tons of places that were outlets for that kind of style of filmmaking. And I think now you're starting to see it kind of come back. Like, it's coming back in vogue, and you see a new generation of people trying to do this thing. But for a good run there, it just disappeared.
Yeah.
You know, that's when you started getting all the superhero kind of comic book things.
Right.
And action movies and science fiction stuff.
They needed to make the big bucks.
Yeah. I mean, like, everything's much more reductive. And especially when the economy went south, like, I guess in between 2007 and 2009, that was like the death knell for all those guys. You know, like, everyone had a harder time kind of making that stuff happen.
So how did you pull yourself together to make your first movie?
It just kind of happened. Like, Mike Zakin, who ran American Zoetrope, he kind of figured out this system with the tax credits in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And he's like, dude, we can make a movie for $1 million. Do you have anything you want to do? And what ultimately, Joshy, was what I had wanted to do. This is back in like 2011 or something, 2012. Yeah. I wanted to make that movie, and I got together Chris Pratt and Pally. It was Pally and I, you know, it was our thing.
Adam Pally,
Chris Pratt, Jake Johnson, and Ben Schwartz got together, and we were going to make this movie. And then Pally's mom passed away. And so I had this tax credit, and then we're like, well, what are we going to do? And then Aubrey's agent remembered this script that I'd written, Life After Bath. And he's like, what about that? It would be perfect for Aubrey. And I was like, holy shit. Like, I wrote it for her, but I didn't know her. This like 7 years before I even met her.
Yeah.
And like, I don't know who else would have done that. You know, like,
right.
It was like, I think Zooey Deschanel or someone we were talking about, but
yeah,
like no one can do what Aubrey did in that movie. I know you haven't seen it, but it's like, it's basically like a vehicle for Aubrey, even though I didn't know who she was.
Right.
And then we just jammed that through, like, at the last second. As a lot of my movie moves have been like last second, like jumping on opportunities instead of like careful plotting for years.
Yeah.
It's almost just like sort of reading the tea leaves and being like, okay, this can happen right now, and I got to move real quick.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I mean, I thought Joshy was great. I enjoyed it. But you know, this idea of, you know, fate comes and goes. Like, what did you study when you studied Jewish mysticism?
Like, what specifically?
Well, I mean, what did you take from it?
I got way into mysticism at one point. I don't know how that went down. I think when I was a kid, I was studying about the history of Spain and all the different words that come from Arabic words from the Moors, you know, like there's zero and zenith and nadir. And one of them was alchemy, where chemistry ultimately came from. And I was just so blown away by this idea of alchemy, of that there are people that think they can turn lead into gold and live forever. And like, as a kid, that's amazing. But I never like let go of that.
Yeah.
And so especially as I got into high school and college, I was always reading, you know, works that had to do with alchemy, not like New Agey stuff, but like literal original works. And the Kabbalah, which is like the Jewish mysticism, features prominently in that stuff. Like that worldview of this idea of repairing, there's this thing called tikkun, where you find the sparks of divinity in trash basically and elevate it to make it divine, is the basic premise of alchemy.
Yeah.
And so I was definitely, you know, into all that kind of occult shit when I was in college.
Like how far? Like what how did it influence your life?
I mean, at one point I did the lesser banishing ritual of the pentagram.
Yeah.
So like shit like that. But yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say like I'm an occultist,
right,
but there's something poetic and beautiful about it, almost artistic.
Yeah.
And I think as an artist, I think opening yourself up to that process where, I mean, I think ultimately all that stuff is a metaphor. So if you're talking about the, you know, mystical philosophy of the Middle Ages and Renaissance, it's, I don't know what percentage of the people thought they were going to really turn lead into gold, but it's, you're transforming your soul. I mean, you look at Carl Jung stuff,
and
Carl Jung super identified how that is completely mimicking, or not mimicking, but mirroring what's going on in our brain and how our unconscious works with our conscious mind. And so there is something to be said about that. And I think opening yourself up to that kind of like logic, or I don't know if it's logic, but sort of that imagery and that sort of allegorical stuff.
Right.
It kind of creates a conduit for, I guess, creativity.
But you also have to be careful that you have some context in place, or it can get pretty crazy making.
Like Aleister Crowley, Golden Dawn style?
Well, I mean, that had a context, you know, that practical magic business, but even in reading you know mystical texts and you know, looking at it as allegory, that, you know, sometimes, you know, the dark side of that, if you get hung up on it or or sort of crossing over it into being like, well, this is real, you know, where you get into Da Vinci Code land, that can kind of crush you in the same way that Avatar does.
For sure. I mean, I definitely read Holy Blood, Holy Grail, but I also had read Foucault's Pendulum by Umberto Eco, which is poking fun at satire of all that kind of stuff, too. I mean, I always had a sense of humor about it.
Yeah.
I was never, like, you know, wearing robes and, you know, trying to conjure demons. Sure. And if anything, it was more just, for me, it was more just kind of coming up with a cosmogony, like trying to come up with a worldview, trying to come up with like some structure to the universe that isn't as obvious as religion or science.
Yeah.
That there is something like I feel like you can tap into that is a little bit bigger than us, that has a structure to it.
Yeah.
So that was always what was really interesting. I never really wanted to manipulate it for my own ends.
Sure.
But I did feel like there is some kind of sympathy there.
But you do believe in like the, you know, the prophecy of dream and the dubious timing of things that transcend coincidence.
Absolutely. I mean, I've had dreams that have come true, like obviously with the weird eyeball thing. I've had weird out of body experiences that I was able to verify, you know, like with people, I was able to see people doing stuff as they were doing it, and they were able to like say that actually happened. So I don't necessarily think that that's supernatural. I think it's natural. We just don't understand the extent of it.
Or the, you know, what parts of our brain have been shut down out of necessity to function as humans.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was it Seneca or
maybe
Cicero?
Not even necessity. Maybe that were shut down for us to be civilized.
I think it was like Seneca said, the only thing that's stopping us from walking on water is our doubt. You know, like I obviously like then you can't not think of it. But yeah, I think like the ability of our minds are obviously we don't know to what extent what we're capable of. So we
or
just,
what we're connected to,
or what how we're connected, or how we're connected, or you know, like I've read all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, there's ideas that our brains are just basically antennas, and we're just picking up, you know, signals, and that's what we are.
Right.
But I don't know. I don't have any answer. I just know there's a lot more going on than what we explain.
Good. Good. Yeah. Thank. I'm happy to know that. Thanks for talking to me, man.
Yeah, of course.
All right, man, that was a high-octane conversation, intense and engaged and good. I like that guy, smart guy, good director, interesting fellow. As I said earlier, The Little Hours is now playing in New York and L.A. It's going to be expanding throughout the country soon. Maybe I'll play some guitar. It's been a few days, and I know a lot of you are just clamoring to hear me fucking noodle and repeat myself. Hold on. So, dead, deaf, black cat, blues meditation, I think. I think I'll try to do that. Goodbye, deaf black cat. Boomer lives!